From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. You listen to public radio, so you probably know that public broadcasting's federal funding came under the axe again. Half of the $200 million proposed cut was restored by a House amendment on Thursday, but the exercise itself was instructive. The cut was put forth partly as an austerity measure and partly, some say, as a response to perceived bias. It seems some legislators wanted to clip the wings not of Big Bird, but Bill Moyers, and salt the ground he walked upon.
The flag belongs to the country, not to the government.
Moyers read from one of his PBS commentaries in a recent speech.
And it reminds me that it's not un-American to think that war, except in self-defense, is a failure of moral imagination, political nerve, and diplomacy.
The issue of bias was raised explicitly by Ken Tomlinson, chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, through which federal money flows to the public broadcasting system. He hired a conservative ideologue, Fred Mann, to monitor bias in Moyers' PBS show. And this week, the CPB board announced its new president will be former State Department official and Republican National Committee co-chair Patricia Harrison, who North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan described as a partisan political figure entirely wrong for the job. After all, the CPB board is supposed to act as a political heat shield for public broadcasting, but since it's appointed by the president, that's hard to do. So every year, public broadcasters trudge up Capitol Hill to justify their subsidy, and every 10 years or so, like right now, a critical mass of peeved lawmakers scare the bejesus out of them. And lately, it's not just lawmakers.
Michael in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian.
How you doing?
My thought is I think all federal funding should be removed from public broadcasting. I love this station and others I listen to. Yeah, I would pay more not to have the federal government in any way, subtly or otherwise, influencing the content of the radio.
Well, that's an understandable sentiment, but a wrong one.
Larry Grossman was the president of PBS from 1976 to 1984.
Because to be independent of government funding means that it would have to depend on corporate funding all the more for the programming. The advantage that public broadcasting has is that the public supports it, corporations support it, foundations support it, local governments support it, and federal governments support it. So nobody has total control.
I would certainly disagree with Larry.
Gerald Starr is the executive director of Citizens for Independent Public Broadcasting.
What you've got, basically, is a system whereby those sources of money, corporate underwriting, conservative politicians, affluent, and I stress affluent subscribers, are the ones who control the purse strings, and as such, they're the ones who call the tune. And this has been demonstrated time and again in in-depth studies of public broadcasting.
And Starr has a solution, a new funding structure, specifically a public trust like those supporting the U.S. Olympic Committee or Little League Baseball. The government would have a role, but not one that would require those trudges up Capitol Hill. Starr believes the public might actually be willing to embrace taxes on digital set-top boxes that someday every viewer will need. And if not the public, how about a little tax on commercial broadcasters, who Starr says have had a free ride for a very long time?
We've done national polling on the subject. We had 79% support for commercial broadcasters paying 5% of their profits into a fund to support public broadcasting. That's more than we would need.
Of course, in that case, it would be the people versus the lobbying power of big media, a titanic battle that would probably be too close to call. And there's still another possible source of funding. The government is in the process of moving American television from the current analog system to a digital one. When that transition occurs, it plans to auction off those analog frequencies and reap a multi-billion dollar windfall. PBS President Pat Mitchell wants the federal subsidy to continue, but she'd also like a piece of that auction pie.
We have a bill on Capitol Hill right now, which is asking that when this analog spectrum is auctioned off, that some of the proceeds from this spectrum be put into a trust fund that would start to create a more sustainable fund for stations, producers, and PBS.
It makes a good deal of sense on paper, but everybody would like to get their hands on those billions from the sale.
Steve Behrens is the editor of the public broadcasting newspaper, Current.
The government's been counting on it to balance the budget.
And when does that happen, that sale?
No one knows. It could be in the next few years, but given the difficulty of moving people, Grandma, for instance, off of her old Admiral, it could take quite a while.
Meanwhile, Jack Schaefer, who writes the press box column for Slate, has a novel approach. Public TV and radio stations currently occupy some prime real estate on the broadcast spectrum. For public radio, most of those stations are on frequencies reserved for non-commercial use. Schaefer says the government should free those stations to use those frequencies as they wish, without restrictions, and just walk away. He says in some markets, public radio has more than it needs. Why not sell a station or two for the greater good of public radio?
Like in my market here in Washington, D.C., I have three different stations that I can listen to Morning Edition on. Three overlapping FM stations. What sort of sense does that make?
None of them would volunteer to put their head on the chopping block.
Steve Behrens.
Every one of them believes they have a reason to exist and as much of a reason as the next guy. So why should it be them that would be sacrificed?
But Schaefer says that with a little creativity, public radio could share.
You know that the big fat chunks of spectrum that they own can be subdivided, that you can compress and digitally encode radio programs on those frequencies. You can probably increase the number of stations that you could run on any one of these. And why not rent or sell half of it?
But right now, hardly anyone has or even sells digital radios that could pick those signals up. As for public television, Schaefer notes that those stations are in line for a new big chunk of digital frequency, part of which they could lease or sell.
If I had a multi-billion dollar set of assets and I came to you and said, Brooke, can you give me a buck and a half for a cup of coffee? You'd say, screw you, Jack. Why don't you convert some of those resources into an endowment for your daily cup of coffee and not come and ask me? And if I came back to you and I said, you know, Brooke, society is so improved. If I have a cup of coffee every day, surely you should want to subsidize my cup of coffee. Once again, you'd say, Jack, you're sitting on billions of dollars worth of assets.
Schaefer is a libertarian, so he doesn't cotton to the idea that public broadcasting needs public money to do public service. But that's a minority view, to be sure. PBS President Pat Mitchell.
Yet again this year, in a Roper poll, Americans said they ranked their taxpayer dollar investment, and it is only about $1 per taxpayer, they rank that second in terms of value, return on that investment, second only to military defense.
That point is not lost on Capitol Hill. Legislators in the Nixon era, in the Reagan era, the Gingrich era, and now in the Bush era have each taken a whack at public broadcasting, only to find themselves pinned and gasping under the lethal talons of Big Bird. In fact, creating some sort of public broadcasting endowment is starting to look pretty good, even to conservative Republican congressmen like Cliff Stearns of Florida.
I think conservatives are saying that there is a possibility that we could work out a lump sum settlement. I don't know how much it would be. Maybe it would be a small amount, maybe be a little amount, but...
That's a big choice, a small amount or a little amount.
Well, I think that's what would be argued. But again, I think we have to consider that every year that there's going to be some reduction in the Corporation for Public Broadcast just because we're trying to balance a budget.
And so would you support the idea of a lump sum payment to get CPB and your constituents off your back?
Well, I would support looking at some kind of lump sum if, in the end, we could agree that this is a one-time, never again, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is on its own.
Someday, maybe. Most public broadcasters are conservative when it comes to money. Changing the system, not to mention arguing about the size of that possible one-time endowment, is likely to cause cold sweats. But former PBS President Larry Grossman says there's a positive side to these periodic arguments in Washington.
Thomas Jefferson used to say that a little revolution every once in a while is good for democracy. The threat of political interference tends to bring out the best in the leadership of public broadcasting and certainly among its supporters.
When President Lyndon Johnson created the CPB in 1967, he was fully aware of that threat.
If public television is to fulfill our hopes, then the corporation must be representative. It must be responsible, and it must be long on enlightened leadership.
Every so often, the Washington establishment appears to be somewhat less than representative on the issue of public broadcasting. So the time may come when Congress will decide to hand over a lump sum, hopefully big enough to ensure the health of the system, and cut it loose. There will still be arguments, loud and rancorous ones, between public broadcasting and its patrons, its viewers, its communities. But then, if the system falters, it will have no one but itself to blame. By the way, when President Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act on November 7, 1967, he was thinking far beyond the potential of public broadcasting.
I think we must consider new ways to build a great network for knowledge, not just a broadcast system, but one that employs every means of sending and of storing information that the individual can use.
Okay, here's the part. The part where Lyndon Baines Johnson, in his perfervid imagination, invents the Internet.
The country doctor getting help from a distant laboratory or a teaching hospital. A scholar in Atlanta might draw instantly on a library in New York. A famous teacher could reach with ideas and inspirations into some far-off classroom so that no child need be neglected. Eventually, I think this electronic knowledge bank could be as valuable as the Federal Reserve Bank. And such a system could involve other nations. It could involve them in a partnership to share knowledge and to thus enrich all mankind. A wild and visionary idea? Not at all. Yesterday's strangest dreams are today's headline, and change is getting swifter every moment.
Who knew? Coming up, Hillary and Rupert sitting in a tree of political expedience. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, the New York Observer took note of an odd kind of political flirtation taking place between none other than the media mogul from Australia and the junior senator from New York. The power and money that naturally flows from politics and media often make for strange bedfellows, but Hillary Clinton and Rupert Murdoch? I mean, really? Well, why not? Ben Smith wrote the piece called The Odd Couple 08, and he joins me now. Ben, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
To put Murdoch's potential political pull into some context here, what happened for Tony Blair after he got cozy with Murdoch?
Murdoch had been a great devotee of Margaret Thatcher, but didn't like the way John Major, her successor, had treated her, didn't like the way the British Conservatives had treated her. And so invited Tony Blair, the new Labour leader, to a retreat on the Hayman Islands off Australia in 1995. And over the next couple of years, they grew closer. I think his crusading tabloid, The Sun, which has, I think, more circulation than all the broadsheets there combined, started, I think, serializing Blair's personal essays and endorsed Labour in the 1997 elections, crusaded for them, and are widely thought to have perhaps, you know, provided the margin.
And do you know what Blair gave him in return for his support? A few regulatory breaks, perhaps?
Yeah, Blair's communications policy was helpful to Murdoch's new TV interests in cable and satellite.
So what has Murdoch's relationship, or at least his newspaper, the New York Post's relationship with Hillary, been up until now?
During her 2000 Senate campaign, the Post was incredibly hard on her. New York Magazine's Mike Tomasky actually counted, and they had something like 217 negative stories about her, 7 positive, maybe 10 or 15 neutral by his count. And since she's been in the Senate, that has really changed. I mean, she has courted them extremely hard, given their reporters access, treated them at least as well as any other publication, and the editorial page has softened and the news pages have softened.
So give me some of the evidence that you've gathered that this relationship between Murdoch and Hillary is in fact warming up.
Well, the most striking thing is the New York Post and the way in which it's in recent weeks gone after this attack biography of Hillary, a book by Ed Klein called The Truth About Hillary. First, Page Six, the feared gossip page, trashed it. Wednesday, the news pages had a roundup of negative reviews of the book under the heading Anti-Hill Swill Bashed, and the same day a columnist, John Podhoretz, went after the book on the op-ed page.
They went after the book that goes after Hillary, but do they actually stand with Hillary on anything?
The most, I think, strictly and strongly positive editorial she's ever gotten from the paper came earlier this year when they wrote an editorial just to say that she had the best stance on the war that they could imagine from a Democrat.
And what about the personal contacts between Hillary and Murdoch, or the Clintons and Murdoch?
Hillary and Rupert had lunch at News Corp headquarters in a private dining room in 2002, which, according to a person there, was very cordial, which I know a lot of people might find hard to imagine. And Bill, who kind of works as Hillary's political operative in a certain way, has been courting him, you know, assiduously. And in fact, he's holding this kind of Davos on the Hudson Clinton Global Initiative conference this fall, to which, you know, a handful of royals and heads of state are invited to, maybe a dozen, two dozen people. Only 2 business leaders are invited, and one of them is Rupert Murdoch.
Wherefore this warming relationship between Murdoch and Hillary Clinton? I mean, what's in it for both of them?
Well, for Hillary, I mean, it's just, you know, you want to have all the friends you can get. And one of the Clintons' great geniuses has always been, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer. For Murdoch, a lot of people who've written about him and who've known him say he's not an ideologue. You know, what he wants is to advance his business interests, and he's attracted to powerful, decisive people more than he is to a particular set of policies. What one person suggested to me is that, I mean, you don't want to be taken for granted, and to the extent to which Murdoch's media empire is seen as an arm of the conservative movement or of the Republican Party, to that extent, it's harder for him to ask for things from the conservative movement and the Republican Party, not easier. I mean, they're going to be more solicitous of him if they're afraid that he's going to jump ship.
It does put his journalistic operations in a rather peculiar position, though, if that is indeed what's going on, because in New York, Hillary Clinton has a Senate run to think about and is supposed to contend with the New York Post, and then she may have a presidential run to think about, and then she'll have to deal with Fox News. What will happen to these typically right-leaning news outlets if their boss puts himself in Hillary's corner?
Well, Rupert has always made the calls on the endorsements at the New York Post and in his newspaper empire. I mean, that's traditional for the publisher to do that. And the New York Post has endorsed Democrats before, endorsed Chuck Schumer for re-election, and it's already begun to beat up one of the potential opponents to Mrs. Clinton, a guy called Ed Cox, Richard Nixon's son-in-law. And it just seemed like they certainly opened the door to endorsing Mrs. Clinton.
But Murdoch hasn't called the shots for Fox News's editorial orientation. That's always been the province of Roger Ailes.
It's certainly hard to see Fox News pivoting toward Hillary the way The Sun pivoted toward Tony Blair in England, for example. I mean, Fox's business model is very much about being a conservative network, and they make huge amounts of money. And an executive at News Corp just dismissed the idea on the grounds that they don't want to lose that money.
As we said at the outset, Murdoch is widely regarded as having been crucial to Tony Blair's win. It's unlikely that he can have anywhere near that kind of influence on Hillary's chances.
Well, there's nothing like the English Sun here. He doesn't have an outlet that can make or break an election. But, I mean, if Fox News could turn the dial 2 degrees toward fair and balanced and away from tearing the Democratic nominee to shreds or was a bit harder on the Republican nominee, I mean, I think, sure, that could make a difference. And, I mean, I think John Kerry's people would certainly tell you that straighter coverage from Fox could help a Democrat.
Well, Ben, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Ben Smith writes for The New York Observer. In 2002, Michael Finkel was fired from the New York Times Magazine for creating a composite central character for a piece about child slavery in West Africa. Having been caught committing that journalistic capital offense, Finkel retreated to await the Times announcement of his dismissal. But the day before he was publicly shamed in the Gray Lady's pages, another reporter called Finkel, asking him about an Oregon man named Christian Longo, wanted for the murder of his family, who'd been arrested in Mexico pretending to be New York Times writer Michael Finkel. Finkel, both stunned and intrigued by the potential for a story that might salvage his career, formed an odd relationship with Longo that endured through his murder conviction. Finkel's new book, called True Story, tells Longo's story, muses on the slipperiness of lies and liars from the inside out, and takes a shot, perhaps the author's last, at a kind of repertorial redemption. Michael Finkel joins me now. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brooke.
You were pretty much a boy wonder, bound for glory. How did you get derailed?
Well, I like to write in the evening, and it was literally 36 hours without sleep. I was struggling with how to construct this story, and so no excuses, but I was exhausted and under a deadline pressure, and I convinced myself, or I deluded myself, that serving a higher truth, you know, proving or showing that there's no slavery was more important than paying attention to the lower truths. It was an evening of weakness, and after I handed it in, I almost was hoping that my editor would say, this is terrible. But she didn't, and I didn't tell her that it was falsely constructed.
So you were blown up in one ethical minefield and then immediately entered another. What went through your mind when you got that call from a reporter about Christian Longo assuming your identity?
That moment is indelibly etched on my mind. It's the most confounding moment. You know, you find out that a murderer has taken on your identity. There's this natural sense of repulsion. But if you're a journalist, there's also this weird itch that I guess could best be described as curiosity or wanting to know more. I wrote a letter to Christian Longo. It was one of the oddest letters I've had to write in my life, and mailed it off to the Lincoln County Jail.
Could you read a little bit of that letter that you sent to Longo?
Here's the way the letter begins. Dear Mr. Longo, yes, it is actually me, Michael Finkel of the New York Times, or rather, formerly of the New York Times. To tell you the truth, I was just recently fired. I invented a character in one of my recent stories, and I was caught and was very publicly fired. So now I am out of a job. I understand that while you were in Mexico, you used my name. I understand that you're facing an upcoming trial, and there's probably much that you are unable to talk about, but I was hoping you would agree to meet with me. I'd like to do this because at the same time that you were using my name, I lost my own.
What could Longo do for you?
It seemed like a cosmic coincidence and something, you know, frankly, at the time to divert my mind from what I was going through. It was like a welcome distraction, perversely.
Longo, you wrote, was charming. He was prone to lying. And your book is very upfront about your feelings for him as he both befriended you and lied to you. What responsibilities did you decide you had in your dealings with Longo?
My relationship with Christian Longo was a constant ethical battle. I was never sure what the right thing to do was. You know, how many friendly overtures can you make to a person who seemed very likely to have killed four people, his wife and his three children? At the outset of our relationship, Longo said to me that he'd read many of my articles and he knew that I was a thorough journalist. And he said, I'm going to prove to you my innocence, and I just ask that you give me the benefit of the doubt. And I felt very comfortable maintaining, you know, the assumption of innocence until proven guilty. I never really thought he was innocent, but I was willing to listen with as open a mind as possible. And so that's sort of the way I allowed myself to listen to Longo's entire saga.
And now, in your book, you find yourself identifying with Longo, a repellent, homicidal liar. In what way did he resonate with you?
You know, I obviously, you know, made a mistake with the New York Times and had some vein of deception that ran through me. And when I looked at Longo at times, I imagined my flaws projected on a screen the size of an IMAX movie theater. It was like, I don't mean to make any comparisons between what Longo did and my deceptions, but in a way it was my worst attributes writ enormous. And it was a very frightening experience.
Did you learn anything, though, Michael, from studying him, from trying to puzzle him out about the nature of liars?
How can you tell when someone's lying to you? I attempted, of course, the standard ways. They double-checked every single fact that Longo mentioned in his letters, and they all checked out. But there was so much that you couldn't check, you know, what kind of a father he was, what kind of a relationship he had with his children. All those people were dead. And I always thought, as a journalist, I had a very good sense of whom to trust. And I have to say that my long encounters with Chris Longo completely pulled the rug out from under me. I could never catch him in a lie. It was so impossible to detect. It rattled me. And I still actually haven't recovered from the whole experience. It made me question my own abilities as a reader of other humans. I really hope that listeners don't ever encounter anyone like Christian Longo.
Journalistic redemption has no prescribed path. Now, before you learned of the Longo coincidence, did you think about how you might salvage your career?
Well, I knew that what I'd done with the New York Times story was an isolated incident, and I was thankful that the New York Times was investigating all of my other articles. And they actually did run a second editor's note saying that they found no other significant errors. And after that second note ran, a few other magazine editors or some very good magazines said that they were willing to give me a second chance, not the New York Times, but other publications. And so I was going to slowly rebuild my journalistic career as best I could. Obviously, you know, number one would be to ensure that any article I wrote would be beyond any category clean. It would be like the Kobe beef of articles.
So in the future, you may write for, say, National Geographic Explorer or some ski magazines and the other magazines that say you'll still be welcome there, but you're no longer considered a reporter qualified to write for the Times. How much does that bother you?
Oh, even just hearing you say it, it hurts. I understand. I don't blame the New York Times for doing what they did. I would have done it to myself if I was the editor. There's not much I can do about it except move on.
Michael Finkel, thank you very much.
Brooke, it's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Michael Finkel is the author of True Story. He's just embarked on a long and uncertain road to journalistic redemption. David Brock, on the other hand, may well be in the final stretch. Now he runs an avowedly liberal media watchdog group, MediaMatters.org, that specializes in fact-checking. But once, Brock was a staunchly conservative journalist, one who led the charge to smear attorney Anita Hill when she testified against then-Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. In 2002, Brock published a book-length mea culpa called Blinded by the Right, in which he confessed to have been essentially a hack, and sometimes worse than a hack, a hatchet man.
There were activities that I was engaged in when I was in the conservative movement that were wrong, even if some of what was being written might have been factually true. In other words, a strange mix of a political agenda under sort of the guise of journalism, and ultimately there would be situations where you had to make a decision whether the politics trumped the journalism or the other way around. And in some cases, I made the wrong decision and went with the politics rather than with the journalism.
When you were preparing your own mea culpa, did you look around for models of other people who had publicly apologized?
Not public apologies, but I did read some books that told stories of people's ideological transitions. I've read probably all of Norman Podhoretz's books, who's a well-known neoconservative who has, you know, moved from a more liberal position in the 1950s and 1960s to a more conservative position in the 70s and 80s. David Horowitz is another neoconservative. Don't agree with him, but wrote what I thought was quite a good book about his change of ideology and experience.
Interestingly, most of the well-known political conversions are from liberal to conservative ideology because of the famous expression, anybody, you'll probably be able to do this better than I can.
I think it's that a neoconservative is a liberal mugged by reality. I did go in the opposite direction, and you're right that there's a whole volume of books written by former liberals and not that many who've moved the other way, although there are a few.
Do you think that morality is really in the eye of the beholder? I'm sure that some of your former colleagues on the political right see what you've done in exposing the environment you used to work in as a kind of betrayal that makes you, in fact, less trustworthy.
Right. I'm sure they do. And the decision that I made was that when the political story moved to impeachment, and I knew a fair amount of information about what had gone on in the anti-Clinton movement, well before anybody knew the name Monica Lewinsky, that I really owed it to the public to tell what I knew. So that was my impulse. I'm sure that conservatives felt that that was a betrayal and was traitorous. I mean, obviously, in some cases, it was a betrayal of some of the personal relationships, but I felt that the story was big enough that it needed to be told and needed to be written down for the sake of history.
Has your time dwelling on journalistic truth given you any insights into how slippery truth can be?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that even though I'm self-identified as a progressive and we make no bones about the point of view of our organization being a progressive organization, I don't have the zeal that I had as a conservative in the sense that I think that I often looked at things in a very black and white way back 10, 12 years. That was sort of the formative way of thinking about things. And I think I see a lot more grays now than I used to.
That is so liberal of you.
Right. Yeah, that's horrible, isn't it?
Anyway, the big question here is, have you been redeemed, David?
Well, I feel as if I have, yeah. And I think that I'm, you know, attempting to take some of the experience that I have that I think was put to bad purposes and to turn it around and use it for good purposes. I think there are some things that I did, particularly involving Anita Hill, that, you know, you maybe can't ever be redeemed for. You can't, it never goes away. A certain kind of damage can't be undone. And I'm aware of that.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Brock is founder of MediaMatters.org and author of Blinded by the Right. Coming up, government lawyers use newspapers to deport people, and cable launches yet another new network. Well, not really. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Recent deportation cases in the country's immigration courts have lawyers concerned about what they call the government's latest tool in the war on terror, journalism. From KPCC in Los Angeles, reporter Rob Schmitz has the story.
On July 27th of last year at 4:45 in the morning, Intisar and Abdeljabbar Hamdan were sleeping.
And I heard the doorbell ring, so I thought maybe I'm dreaming or something. Then I heard it again, so, you know, I start getting up, then start banging on the door, you know.
They hurried downstairs and asked who it was. The FBI, a man replied. Intisar grabbed a scarf to cover her head.
So we opened the door, and 9 of them came in the house. And at that moment, you know, like you're in a movie or something.
She says the agents pointed their guns at the couple, told them to sit down, and then searched the house. They told Mr. Hamdan to take off his wedding ring and his watch. They handcuffed him, told Mrs. Hamdan to have a nice day, and then left. An immigrant from Jordan who has lived in the U.S. for 25 years, Hamdan has been held at a federal detention facility in San Pedro nearly a year, declared a national security threat. The government says Hamdan's former employer, the Dallas-based Holy Land Foundation, raised money for the terrorist group Hamas. It accuses Hamdan of knowing about the connection. ACLU lawyer Ranjana Natarajan says while preparing Hamdan's defense, she noticed something peculiar about the exhibits the government was using as evidence.
The government used dozens upon dozens of newspaper articles in their case. And, for example, they had many, many articles talking about terrorist incidents in Israel that had nothing to do with Mr. Hamdan, with the Holy Land Foundation, or any of the allegations in the case.
It's common knowledge among legal scholars that in a criminal court, journalism normally is regarded as hearsay. Judges rarely allow it to be entered as evidence for what Natarajan calls good reason.
Newspaper articles are notoriously unreliable, and they're not, for example, sworn testimony that you get in a court, and that's why they're almost never used.
That is, in criminal court. But journalism does show up in immigration cases, now more than ever. According to the American Immigration Lawyers Association, since 9/11, the government has increasingly used journalism to bolster deportation cases against people accused of ties with terrorism. Denise Sabah is the general counsel for the association.
For instance, if it was Hamas and they think that the person was involved with Hamas, then there's a tremendous amount of articles about Hamas. But there isn't articles about the individual that's related to Hamas. And it appears that the purpose of these articles is to talk about the terrorist organization, but not really talk about the nexus of the individual's activities with that organization.
University of Southern California immigration law professor Niels Frenzen sees the increased use of journalism in these cases as one way the government can avoid having its evidence or its witnesses scrutinized.
They recognize there are holes in that information, or even worse, they know that there is exculpatory information that their intelligence agents might have, and they simply do not want to make that available in immigration court so that that officer would be cross-examined.
Instead, claims Frenzen, the government uses a newspaper article with similar information, knowing full well a journalist will most likely resist a subpoena.
They know they couldn't get away with this in criminal court, and they would never be able to convict this individual. So they're trying to do what they can't do in criminal court and immigration court, where the rules are just so much more relaxed.
It's true that rules of evidence are less stringent in immigration courts, but Temple Law Professor Jan Ting says that doesn't mean anything. Ting is a former assistant commissioner of the INS, and he says it's up to an immigration judge to take all the evidence into consideration when making a decision. A few sensational allegations written up in a newspaper story, he says, won't swing a case the government's way.
The immigration judge is much less likely than a lay jury to be unduly swayed by journalism. So I honestly cannot see what the problem here is.
Lori Rosenberg, now retired, served as a judge on the Bureau of Immigration Appeals for 7 years, the nation's highest immigration court. She says the government's use of newspaper articles in these cases is disturbing.
I think that the purpose that these are being provided is to say to the judge, look at how bad these groups are. Look at how much violence, death, disregard for human life, mistreatment of civilians they have engaged in. Although that doesn't really say anything about the respondent. So it is a guilt by association technique. There's no question about it.
And if government prosecutors are relying on guilt by association in cases where they're trying to establish something as serious as terrorism, Rosenberg says it won't really protect the security of U.S. citizens in the long run.
I also have a problem with it because I think it leads to incredible injustices, and not just something that's developed since 9/11, but we've seen situations throughout history where the whole idea of guilt by association has ruined people's lives needlessly. I mean, I think back to the McCarthy era when I'm saying this.
In Hamdan's case, lawyer Natarajan says the evidence the government used to establish Hamdan's organization as a terrorist group was another example of guilt by association. In 2001, the Holy Land Foundation was put on the government's list of terrorist groups. The foundation challenged this designation in federal court, citing a lack of sufficient evidence. Almost one half of the exhibits the government entered into evidence was made up of 90 newspaper articles, including one written by former USA Today reporter Jack Kelly. Kelly was later fired by the newspaper in a scandal that revealed he had fabricated and plagiarized numerous stories for the paper, including the story the government used to establish the Holy Land Foundation as a terrorist organization. Manny Van Pelt is a spokesman for the Department of Homeland Security. He says the evidence against the Holy Land Foundation was challenged all the way up to a federal court of appeals, and at each stage, the Holy Land Foundation lost. As to Hamdan's case, he says the government's case for deporting an immigrant rarely hinges on newspaper articles. Moreover, immigrants themselves use the same kind of evidence when seeking asylum in the U.S.
Well, you know, you have to remember that the aliens and their attorneys enter news articles, video footage, you know, State Department reports, advocacy reports, and other public documents all the time.
One journalist whose work was used in the case to attempt to deport Hamdan and at least three other people since 9/11 is Steve McGonigal with the Dallas Morning News. In 1996, he wrote about potential ties the Holy Land Foundation had with Hamas.
I did not write these stories for the government. I did not write these stories for the Holy Land Foundation or its employees. I wrote these stories for, you know, general readership purposes. And I think for any journalist, having your stories used in a prosecutorial way is unsettling.
While legal experts and journalists debate this issue, Abdel Jabbar Hamdan sits in a cell at a federal detention facility in San Pedro. He's entering his 12th month there as his lawyers appeal his case to the Board of Immigration Appeals. Hamdan says he and his wife came to the United States and raised their six children here because people in Jordan have limited rights. Despite his situation, he says he still hasn't lost faith in America's justice system. For On the Media, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
Here's a quandary for an advertiser. You have a product to sell, but the product can't be bought legally, at least not without the help of a middleman. What do you do? Gently implore your audience to gently implore the middleman.
When will you ask your doctor about Lunesta?
If you've always got to go, you may have a treatable medical condition. So ask your doctor about Detrol LA.
Talk to your doctor and find out if Nexium, the perfect...
Ask your doctor about Vitorin.
Ask your doctor about the benefits of Lipitor.
Ask your doctor about Plavix today, because no matter how formidable you are, you're no match for a dangerous clot.
Direct-to-consumer advertising accounts for some $4 billion a year in ad spending, and nearly a third of the ad buys on the nightly network news. And so network execs are no doubt watching anxiously as the entire enterprise comes under increasing scrutiny. Ever since last year's safety scare over the heavily marketed arthritis medications Vioxx and Celebrex, critics have called for stricter limits on the production of so-called DTC ads, and so have several bills now pending in Congress. Even the acting chief of the FDA has called for a crackdown. But the pharmaceutical industry is hoping to head off regulation with its own set of voluntary guidelines due out later this summer. And just last week, Bristol-Myers Squibb announced that it was imposing its own moratorium on all advertising of new drugs for at least a year after they've been approved for sale. We called on advertising counsel Jim Davidson for his perspective. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Brooke.
So could you explain briefly how we got to the point we're at right now with direct-to-consumer ads? I mean, it's a fairly new phenomenon. As recently as 10 years ago, doctors were the primary target of pharmaceutical ads.
Direct-to-consumer advertising has been in the print media since the early 1980s. And then in 1997, they made a determination at FDA that it would permit this type of advertising to appear in broadcast ads on television or radio.
The loosening of the guidelines there was that instead of having to list every single potential side effect, you only had to list the major ones and then direct them to some sort of a website or a place they could get more information.
That's correct. And remember that information in the hands of consumer can empower them to get treatment that they need. 56 million Americans have high blood pressure, but 18 million of them don't know that they have that silent killer.
That's the bright side. The darker side, as suggested in a recent FDA study, is that physicians report that fewer than half of them believe that patients really understand the possible risks of a lot of these DTC-advertised drugs. And 38% of doctors believe the ads caused patients to question their diagnoses, and more than a quarter say that it leads to tension between doctors and patients.
I know that survey intimately, inside and out, and I can give you countervailing percentages. For example, 72% of those doctors believe that the ads educate and inform patients about treatments that are available to them. And 42% of the doctors agree the ads make the patients more involved in their health care. I think the most important statistic, and this is one that came from a survey that the Food and Drug Administration did, and it was backed up by another survey that Prevention Magazine did.
Mm-hmm.
This survey showed that 25 to 30 million Americans, because they saw an ad for a prescription drug, went to a doctor to talk about a medical condition they had never discussed before. That is a public health revolution.
Jim, I have to question whether or not some of these people are being over-medicated because of the impact of these direct-to-consumer ads. According to a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association this past spring, doctors posed as patients with some symptoms that sort of resemble depression, like fatigue, stress, trouble sleeping, but that don't necessarily require medication. When these people specifically asked their doctors about Paxil, more than half of them walked out with the drug. When they didn't, only 10% of them did.
The people that went into these doctors' offices were trained actors, and they were rehearsed specifically not only how to present a condition relating to depression, but then trained to respond to how the doctors would ask questions. So they were basically trained to fool the doctors. I'm not sure that I've got a lot of confidence in that study.
Do you think that physicians should be taking cues on prescriptions from their patients?
Well, I think that that's an issue really for the medical profession to look at in terms of how its medical education trains people in understanding pharmacology and diagnosis and prescriptions. That's where you should deal with that. The role of the advertising is to get the patient to go in and visit with the physician so the dialogue can start. And about a third to 40% of all the cases where advertising has prompted someone to go visit a physician, the patient came away with a recommendation that had nothing to do with the drug. It was a recommendation for a change in lifestyle or diet or exercise. More importantly, we haven't seen any reported cases anywhere, and it's always difficult to prove a negative, but we haven't seen any reported cases of individuals who have been harmed by a prescription given by a doctor as a result of seeing an ad.
There may not be, but there is the situation, as I mentioned earlier, of Vioxx and Celebrex last year, which were among the most heavily marketed drugs and have created some of this backlash against direct-to-consumer ads. And many, many doctors are saying, let us have some time before you rush your advertisements along with the drugs to market. Let us see, before they're out in the hands of millions of people, how well they work. What's so bad about the Bristol-Myers Squibb idea of a year moratorium on new drug advertising?
Information delayed is information denied. I think a generic rule that says that all medicines should be delayed from being advertised for any period of time hurts people who need treatment that a new drug could provide. And so keeping it arbitrarily away from people, I don't think is a good public policy.
Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke, very much.
Jim Davidson is counsel to the Advertising Coalition, a group of advertising and media trade associations. A headline in this week's USA Today declares that sending teens on group trips can be harrowing. Part of that paper's in-depth coverage of missing vacationer Natalie Holloway. Apparently, it also makes great television. On her blog, HuffingtonPost.com, Arianna Huffington points out that NBC News aired 62 segments on the missing teenager in May and June. Compare that with 6 segments on the Downing Street memo during the same period. And CNN? 294 compared to 30 for the memo, which got us thinking about the future of TV news.
In a surprise move expected to send shockwaves through the world of TV journalism, CNN, the original cable news network, and NBC, which owns cable channels MSNBC and CNBC, announced a deal to consolidate their news divisions into a single giant network. The new network, to be called Where the White Women At, or WWWA, is set to debut this week. CNN spokesman Jack Little explained the deal at a press conference Monday.
For most of history, journalists could afford to spend their time covering wars, famines, politics, and business. The reason for this is that everyone knew where the white women were at home, probably in the kitchen, minding the kids. Sometimes they were out shopping or knitting at a friend's house or even working as elementary school teachers, but by and large, the location of all white women was known. However, society has changed, and the business of journalism has changed with it. These days, with the increased opportunities available to white women, as a nation, we are losing track. White women are disappearing in Aruba from their jobs as Washington interns and even right before their own weddings. With this merger, we will increase the breadth and depth of our missing white women coverage. And so we meet our sacred obligation to keep the electorate informed and aware about where the white women are at.
The new network will include WWWA headline news, which will deliver key missing white women developments every half hour. Most of the network's time will be devoted to covering current missing white women, but there will also be talk shows where groups of white men get together to discuss the significance of past missing white women, imperiled white women, and white women in persistent vegetative states. WWWA debuts in most markets on Monday. Coming up, missing white Boy Scout found in Utah.
We stole that gag from The Poor Man with his permission, or rather from his website, thepoorman.net. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Wolo, and edited by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had help from Paul Heinz. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support from the media comes from Hofstra University, which this November analyzes Bill Clinton's administration at the 11th of its presidential conferences. More details at hofstra.edu. And the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.